Chapter 10. With them, Joe Fernride thought, there is not life but merely a synopsis of life. We are a thread that passes through their hands, always in motion, always flowing. We slip by and are never fully grasped. The slipping away is continuous and carries all of us with it, on and on, toward the dreadful alchemy of the tomb. To Willis, he said, "Can you contact Glimmung?" "You have to say, Willis," he said, "can you contact Glimmung?" Across the room from him, the Kalend stood silently. Not silently as an owl might stand, absorbing and subduing noise with its feathers, but silent in the mechanical sense, as if its audio portion had been severed. "Is it really there?" Joe wondered. It appeared to be substantial. It did not have a ghostly, vaporous, wraith-like quality. "It really is there," he said to himself. "It has invaded my work area before I have placed a single shard into the weightless chamber, before I have ignited one heat needle." "I can't contact Glimmung," Willis said. "He's sleeping. This is his time for that. In another 12 hours he'll wake up, and then I can contact him. But he's left a large number of servo-assistant mechanisms ready in case of an emergency. Do you want any of them activated?" Joe said, "Tell me what to do. Willis, tell me what the hell to do." "About the Kalend? There is no existing record of anyone doing anything about Kalends. Do you want me to research this further?" "There is one particular computer which I can tie into. Perhaps it can make an analysis of your abilities in relation to the nature of the Kalend and formulate a new interaction which..." "Do they die?" Joe said. The robot remained silent. "Willis," he said, "can they be killed?" "That's hard to say," the robot said. "They're not your standard living creature. Also, they all look alike, which makes the problem even more complicated." The Kalend laid a copy of the book on the table beside Joe Fernwright and waited for him to pick it up. Silently, he picked up the book, held it for a time, and then opened it to the page marked. The text read, "That which Joe Fernwright finds in the sunken cathedral will cause him to kill Glimmung and, in doing so, halt forever the raising of Heldskala." "That which I find in the cathedral," Joe said to himself. "Down there, under the water, already down beneath the sea, waiting for me." He thought, "I had better get under the water as soon as I can. Will Glimmung let me?" he wondered, "especially after he has read this. And he is probably reading it right now as I stand here. Certainly he follows every alteration of the text as it grows, changes, corrects itself day after day, hour by hour. If he is smart," Joe thought, "he will kill me first, before I go underwater. Kill me, in fact, now." He stood there, waiting for Glimmung's violence to come on to him. It did not come. "That's right," he remembered. "Glimmung is asleep." On the other hand, he meditated, "maybe I should not go down there. What would Glimmung recommend? Perhaps that should decide it. If Glimmung wanted him to go underwater and inspect the sunken cathedral, then he would. If not, then not. Odd," he thought, "that my first reaction would be to want to go underwater. As if I can't wait to make my discovery. A discovery which will destroy Glimmung and with him the project of raising the cathedral." A perverse response, he decided. A slip on the part of unconscious inhibitions. Maybe this told him something about himself, something which he had not known, something evoked by the Kalend and its book. "The Kalends woke this in me," he realized. "This is the principle on which they operate. By this, they will make their prophecy come true." "Willis," he said, "how does one get down to Heldskala?" "One descends via suit and mask, or via a prolepsis chamber," the robot said. "Can you take me there?" Joe asked. "I mean, Willis..." "Just a moment," the robot said. "There's a call coming through to you. An official call." The robot was silent for a moment. Then it said, "Miss Hilda Rice, Glimmung's personal secretary. She wants to talk to you." A door in the robot's chest popped open, and out on a tray came an audio telephone. "Pick up the receiver," Willis said. Joe picked up the receiver. "Mr. Fernwright," a practiced, competent female voice said, "I have an urgent request for you from Mr. Glimmung, who is now sleeping. He would prefer it if you did not go down to the cathedral right now. He wants you to wait until someone can go with you." "You say request," Joe said. "Am I to assume that that's actually an order, that he's ordering me not to go below water?" "All Mr. Glimmung's instructions," Miss Rice said, "come in the form of requests. He does not order, he always merely requests. So this is actually an order, Joe said. Miss Rice said, I think you understand, Mr. Fernwright. Sometime tomorrow, Mr. Glimmung will contact you. Goodbye. The phone clicked, became dead. It's an order, Joe said. That's right, Willis the robot agreed. That's the way he handles everything, as she cleverly pointed out. But if I tried to go below water... Well, you can't, the robot said flatly. I can, Joe said. I can do it and get fired. You can do it, the robot said, and become killed. Killed, Willis? Killed how, and who by? He felt frightened and angry, a peculiar mixture of emotions that started his vagus nerve into spasms. His breathing, his peristalsis, and his heart rate all changed radically. Killed by who? He demanded. You first have to say, Ah, the hell with it, the robot said. Yes, many feral life forms, many hazards. But normal for a task of this kind, Joe said. I suppose you could say that. But a request like this... I'm going underwater, Joe said. You will find terrible decay down there, decay which you cannot imagine. The underwater world in which Heldskala lies is a place of dead things, a place where everything rots and falls into despair and ruin. That is why Glimmung intends to raise the cathedral. He is unable to endure it down there. Neither will you be able to. Wait until he goes underwater with you. Wait a few days, heal the pots in your workshop, and forget about going below. Glimmung calls it the aquatic subworld. He is right. It's a world made up of its own self, entirely separate from ours, with its own wretched laws, under which everything must decline into rubbish. A world dominated by the force of unyielding entropy and nothing else, where even those with enormous strength, such as Glimmung, become vitiated and lose their power in the end. It is an oceanic grave, and it will kill all of us unless the cathedral can be raised. It can't be all that bad, Joe said. But as he spoke, he felt fear rustle through him and lodge inside his heart, fear generated in part by the vacuity of his own remark. The robot looked at him enigmatically, a complex look that gradually became that of scorn. Considering you're a robot, Joe said, I don't see what you have emotionally involved in this. You have no life. The robot said, No structure, even an artificial one, enjoys the process of entropy. It is the ultimate fate of everything, and everything resists it. Joe said, And Glimmung expects to halt this process? If it's the ultimate fate of everything, then Glimmung can't halt it. He's doomed. He'll fail, and the process will go on. Down below the water, Willis said, the decay process is the only force at work. But up here, the cathedral raised, there will be other forces which do not move in a retrograde manner. Forces of sanction and repair, of building and making and form creating, and in your case, healing. That is why you are so needed. It is you and the others like you who will forestall the decay process by your abilities and work. Do you see? I want to go down there, Joe said. Suit yourself. I mean that literally. Put on diving gear and descend into Mare Nostrum alone in the night. Descend into the subworld of decay and see it for yourself. I'll take you to one of the staging centers floating on Mare Nostrum. You can descend from there, without me. Thanks, Joe said. He uttered the word with what he intended to be irony. However, it emerged in a weak wheeze, and the robot did not seem to catch his tone. The staging center consisted of a platform within hermetically sealed domes, three of them, each large enough for life forms to gather with their equipment. Joe gazed about him in expert appreciation at the size of the construct. Built with robot labor, he decided. And recently, the domes seemed new and probably were so. This installation had been created for him and the others and would not be used until he and they began to operate out of them. Space, he reflected, is not at a premium here as it is on Earth. These domes can be as large as they want, and Glimmung, of course, had wanted them large indeed. And you still won't descend with me, he said to the robot Willis. Never. Show me the diving gear, Joe said, and show me how to use it. Show me everything I need to know. I will show you the minimal... The robot began, and then broke off. On the roof field of the greatest dome, a small airship was landing. Willis scrutinized it intently. Too small for Glimmung, he murmured. It must be a more meager and hence lesser life form. The airship came to a stop. It remained immobile, and then its hatch slid back. Taxi, it proclaimed from its stem to its stern, and out of the taxi stepped Mali Yoyes. She descended via the elevator and came directly toward Joe and the robot Willis.
"Glimmung spoke to me," she said. "He told me what you're doing here. He wanted me to go along with you. There was some doubt in his mind as to whether you could make it alone. I mean, physically survive the experience of the subworld down there."
"And he thinks you can," Joe said.
"He thinks that two of us going together and having each other to rely on, he thinks that that would probably work. And I'm more experienced than you, vastly more."
"Mrs. Lady," Willis said to her, "did Glimmung want me to go undersea too?"
"He didn't mention you," Molly said tartly.
"It's just as well." The robot scowled in heavy gloom. "I dislike it down there."
"But soon," Molly said, "it will all be changed. There will be no down there, only up here in this world, where other laws operate."
"The best laid plans of mice and men," the robot said with frigid skepticism.
"Help us into our gear," Joe said.
The robot said, "Down there in the aquatic subworld, you will be in a place that Amelita has forgotten."
"Who is Amelita?" Joe asked.
Molly said, "The god for whom the cathedral was built. The god who was worshipped in Helskala. When the cathedral is restored, then Glimmung can call upon Amelita, as in earlier times, before the catastrophe in which the cathedral sank. The defeat of Amelita by Borel, a temporary defeat but a major one. I am reminded of a Terran poem by Bert Brecht called The Drowned Girl. Let's see if memory serves. And gradually God forgot her, first her arms, then her legs and body, until she was..."
Joe said, "What sort of deities are these?"
There had been no mention of this before, but of course it was obvious and logical. A cathedral was a place in which to worship, and someone or something had to be the object of the worship. To Molly, he said, "Do you know anything more about this angle?"
"I can fully inform you," the robot said, annoyed.
To it, Molly said, "Had it ever occurred to you that it might be Amelita, working through Glimmung, who is raising the cathedral, so that worship of him here on this planet can resume?"
The robot said in a nettled fashion. Joe could almost hear it whir and click as it cogitated.
"Well," it said all at once, "anyhow, you asked about the two deities, Mr. Sir. However, you once again neglected to say..."
"Willis," Joe said, "tell me about Amelita and Borel. How long have they been worshipped, and on how many planets, and where did the cult begin?"
"I have a brochure," the robot said, "which will exhaustively cover these matters." It slid its hand into its thorax pocket. From the pocket it lifted out a mimeographed pamphlet.
"I wrote this in my spare time," the robot said. "With your permission, I will refer to it. That way I don't have to overtax so much in my memory spools. To begin with, Amelita existed alone. That was roughly 50,000 Terran years in the past. Then, in a spasm of apotheosis, Amelita felt sexual desire. But there was nothing to feel sexual desire toward. He felt love, and there was nothing to love. He felt hate, and there was nothing to hate.
He felt apathy, and there was nothing to feel apathetic about." Molly spoke without emotion. It did not involve her.
"Let's tackle sexual desire first," the robot said. "As is well known, the most enjoyable form of sexual love is that which pertains to incest, inasmuch as incest is the fundamental taboo throughout the universe. The greater the taboo, the more sheer excitement. Hence, Amelita created his sister, Borel. The next most exciting aspect of sexual love is love for someone evil, someone who, if you didn't love them, you would abominate them. So Amelita caused his sister to be evil. She began at once to tear down everything which he had over the centuries built."
Molly murmured, "Such as Helskala."
"Yes, Mrs. Lady," the robot agreed. "Now, the next most powerful stimulant to sexual love is to be in love with someone stronger than you. So Amelita caused his sister to be capable of destroying his edifices one by one. He tried to intervene, but she was by now too strong, as he had intended. Finally, the last element. The love object forces one to descend to its level, where its laws, unethical and violent, obtain. This is what we have here in the raising of Helskala. Every one of you will have to descend into the aquatic subworld in which Amelita's laws do not operate. Even Glimmung himself will inevitably sink into the subworld where Borel's travesty of reality cloaks everything and is everywhere."
"I thought of Glimmung as a deity," Joe said, "because of his immense power."
The robot said, "Deities do not fall 10 floors to the basement."
"That seems reasonable," Joe admitted. The criteria involved, the robot said, start with immortality. Amelita and Borel have that. Glimmung has not. The second criterion deals with...
We are aware of the two other criteria, Molly interrupted. Unlimited power and unlimited knowledge.
Then you've read my pamphlet, the robot said.
Christ, Molly said with withering disdain.
You mention Christ, the robot said. He is an interesting deity because he has only limited power, he has only partial knowledge, and he could die. He fulfills none of the criteria.
Then how did Christianity come into being? Joe said.
It came into being, the robot said, because this is what Christ did. He worried about other people. Worry is the true translation of the Greek agape and the Latin caritas. Christ stands empty-handed. He can save no one, not even himself. And yet, by his concern, his esteem for others, he transcends...
Just give us the pamphlet, Molly said wearily. We'll read it in our spare time. As of now, we're going under the water. Get our diving gear ready, as Mr. Fernwright asked.
There is a somewhat similar deity, the robot said, on Beta 12. This deity learned how to die whenever another creature on his planet died. He could not die in place of them, but he could die with them. And then, as each new creature was born, he was restored. So he has endured countless deaths and rebirths, as compared with Christ, who died only once. This, too, is dealt with in my pamphlet. Everything is in my pamphlet.
Then you're a Kaland, Joe said. The robot eyed him, long and carefully, and silently.
And your pamphlet, Joe said, is the Book of the Kalands.
Not exactly, the robot said at last.
Meaning what? Molly demanded sharply.
Meaning that I have based my various pamphlets on the Book of the Kalands.
Why? Joe said.
The robot hesitated and then said, I hope to be a freelance writer someday.
Get our gear, Molly said with overwhelming weariness. An odd random thought entered Joe's mind. Possibly it had emerged because of the discussion about Christ.
Worry, he said aloud, echoing the robot's term.
I think I know what you mean. A strange thing happened to me once back on Earth. A very small thing. I got down a cup from the cupboard, a cup I hardly ever used. In it, I found a spider, a dead spider. It had died because there was nothing for it to eat. Obviously, it had fallen into the cup and couldn't get out. But here's the point. It had woven a web at the bottom of the cup, as good a web as it could weave under the circumstances. When I found it, saw it dead in the cup with its meager, hopeless web, I thought it never had a chance. No flies would ever have come along, even if it had waited forever. It waited until it died. It tried to make the best of the circumstances, but it was hopeless. I always wondered, did it know it was hopeless? Did it weave the web, knowing it was no use?
Little tragedy of life, the robot said. Billions of them, unnoticed every day. Except that God notices, at least according to my pamphlet.
But I see what you mean, Joe said, about worry. Concern, that's closer to it. I felt it concerned me. It did concern me. Caritas. Or in the Greek...
He could not remember the word.
Can we go below now? Molly asked.
Yes, Joe said. Obviously, she did not understand, but oddly, the robot did.
Strange, Joe thought. Why does it understand when she doesn't?
Maybe Caritas is a factor of intelligence, he reflected.
Maybe we've always been wrong. Caritas is not a feeling, but a high form of cerebral activity, an ability to perceive something in the environment, to notice, and, as the robot had put it, to worry. Cognition, he realized. That's what it is. It isn't a case of feeling versus thinking. Cognition is cognition.
Aloud, he said, Can I have a copy of your pamphlet?
10 cents, please, the robot said, holding out the pamphlet.
Joe fished out a cardboard dime and handed it to the robot.
To Molly, he said, Now let's go below.
Chapter 11. The robot touched a switch. A wall locker opened its sliding door, and Joe saw within complete sets of diving gear. Oxygen masks, pedal flippers, plastic skin suits, waterproof light sources, weights, pry bars, crossbows, oxygen and helium tanks, everything, including many assorted items of equipment which he could not identify.
In view of your lack of experience in deep-sea diving, the robot said, I would suggest you descend by spherical prolepsis chamber. But if you want to suit up...
It shrugged.
I have no control over that. The decision is yours.
I've had sufficient experience, Molly said briskly. She began bringing equipment out of the locker. Presently, she had a formidable heap stacked neatly before her.
Get out what I got out, she instructed Joe. Put the segments of the suit on in the order I'm putting them on, and in the same way.
They suited up, and then, led by Willis, they made their way to the staging chamber proper.
Sometime, the robot said as it unscrewed the great plug valve in the floor of the chamber, I intend to write a pamphlet on deep-sea diving. There is a basic assumption that the thonic world is in the ground. You find this in every religion. But in actuality, it's in the ocean. The ocean, it dragged the huge plug away, is the actual primordial world out of which every living thing came a billion years ago. On your planet, Mr. Fernwright, this error is found in many religions. For instance, the Greek goddess Demeter and her daughter Kore, they come up from the earth.
Molly said to Joe, There is attached to your belt an emergency device in case of failure in the oxygen circuit of your rig. If you lose your air, if the conduit loosens or bursts or the tank runs dry, activate the hypo plunger of the belt unit.
She pointed to the one mounted on her own belt. It swiftly drops metabolic processes so that your need for oxygen is minimal. Little enough so that you can easily float to the surface before you suffer any brain damage or experience any other lasting physiological effect from the curtailed oxygen supply. When you float to the surface, you will of course be unconscious, but your mask is designed to let in air automatically. It will respond to the altered condition, the presence of outside air, and then I'll be up to steer you back here.
I must be gone, Joe quoted, trying to remember how it went. There is a grave where daffodil and lily wave.
The robot said, And I would please the hapless fawn, buried under the sleepy ground.
A favorite of mine, Yeats, I believe. Do you think, Mr. Sir, that you are descending into a grave? That what stands before you is death? That to descend is to die? Answer in 25 words or less.
I know what the Callan told me, Joe said somberly. What I find in Heldskala will cause me to kill Glimmung. So it is into death that I'm going. Maybe not my death, but someone else's. To permanently halt the raising of Heldskala.
Grimly, the words flowed within his mind, always at the surface, always available. They would not sink out of sight for a long, long time. Perhaps, he thought, never. The stigma is upon me, and I will carry it the rest of my life.
I will give you a lucky charm, the robot said. Again, it rummaged within its chest pocket. It presently brought out a tiny packet, which it handed to Joe.
A token which represents the purity and sublimity of Amelita. A symbol, so to speak.
And it'll ward off evil influences? Joe asked.
The robot said, You must say, Willis, will it ward...
Willis, Joe said, will this charm help us down there?
After a pause, the robot said, No.
Then why did you give it to him? Molly asked caustically.
The robot hesitated.
Never mind.
It seemed then to retract into itself. It became silent, distantly inert.
I'm going to lash us up in tandem, Molly said to Joe as she attached a cable from her belt to his. This will give us 20 feet of free line. That should be enough. I can't risk getting separated from you. That might be the last we'd see of you.
The robot wordlessly handed Joe a plastic carton.
What for? Joe said.
You probably will find a broken pot or two down there. And you'll want to bring the shards up.
Stalking cat-like to the aperture in the floor of the staging chamber, Molly said, Let's go. She snapped on her helium-powered torch, glanced briefly at Joe, and then dived out of sight. The 20-foot cable attached to him stretched taut, pulled him. It walked him to the aperture, propelling him, and then, his mind blank of any real thoughts, he dived too, passively. The light of the staging chamber faded out above him. He snapped on his own torch and allowed himself to be tugged along, down and down. The water became utterly black, except for the vague, seemingly half-real quadrant illuminated by his torch. And below him, Molly's torch glowed like the phosphorescent light of an exceedingly deep sea fish.
Are you okay?
Molly's voice sounded in his ear. It startled him, and then he realized that a two-way intercom connected them.
Yes, he said.
Various fish floated past him, incurious and pompous. They gawked at him and traveled on, disappearing into the void surrounding his illuminated path.
That windbag robot, Molly said scathingly.
My God, we must have conversed with it for 20 minutes.
But, Joe thought, we are here now, within the waters of Mare Nostrum, spiraling down and down. I wonder, he thought, how many theologically inclined robots there are in the universe. Perhaps Willis was the only one, put there by Glimmung to talk at extended length, thus interfering with the attempt to go below the surface. The heat unit of his suit snapped on. He felt the cold of the sea ebb away from him, and for that he gave thanks.
Joe Fernwright, Molly's voice sounded in his ear. Did it occur to you that Glimmung might have sent me here to go below with you as we're doing to kill you? Glimmung knows the prophecy. Wouldn't it be reasonable for him to do that? So obvious. Didn't you think at all of that?
As a matter of fact, he had not. And thinking it now, he felt the chill of the ocean ease back into its grip around him. The enervating cold plundered his loins, his heart. He felt himself freeze within into frightened immobility, like a defenseless minor creature. His fear deprived him of his sense of being human, of being a man. It was not a man's fear. It was the fear of a small animal. It shrank him, as if devolving him into ages past. It eradicated the contemporary aspects of his self, his being. God, he thought, I'm feeling a fear that is millions of years old. On the other hand, Molly pointed out, the text which the Kaland showed you might have been a forgery, prepared for your benefit. One single copy for your eyes alone. Joe said hoarsely, how did you know about the Kaland and the new text? Glimmung told me. Then he read what I read. It isn't a forgery for my benefit. If it was, you wouldn't be here. She laughed and said nothing. And on they spiraled downward. Then I can assume I'm right, Joe said. Stark and yellow, the hull of something gleamed and putrefied within the focus of his torch. To his right, Molly's torch lit up another vertebra of it. Huge, like an ark that had been built to contain every living thing. And an ark which had sunk to the bottom of Mare Nostrum. Forever. The ark, he thought, a failure.
What is it? He asked Molly. A skeleton?
Of what? He thrashed toward it, sweeping out as much of it as possible with his torch. Simultaneously, Molly did the same. She bobbed close to him then. He could see her face through the transparent plastic disc of her oxygen mask. When she spoke, her tone was subdued, as if, despite her knowledge and experience, she had not expected to find this here.
It's a Glimmung, she said, the skeleton of an ancient, archaic, long-dead, forgotten Glimmung. It's coral-encrusted terribly. It's been down here, I would say, for a century at least. Good Lord.
You mean you didn't know it was here? He demanded.
Maybe Glimmung, not me, but...
She hesitated.
I think it's a black Glimmung.
What's this? Joe asked, and his uneasiness burgeoned. It filled him and became by degrees overwhelming dread.
It's almost impossible to explain, Molly said. As with antimatter, you can talk about it, but you can't really imagine what the words mean. There are Glimmungs, and there are black Glimmungs, always on a 1-to-1 ratio. Each individual Glimmung has his counterpart, his opaque doppelganger. Sooner or later during his life, he must kill his black counterpart, or it will kill him.
Why? Joe said.
Because that's the way it is. It's like asking, why is a stone? Do you see? They evolved this way, on this strange parity basis. They are mutually exclusive, antagonistic entities, or if you prefer, properties. Yes, properties like chemical combinations. You see, the black Glimmungs are not precisely alive. And yet they're not biochemically inert either. They're like malformed crystals with the form-destroying principle motivating them. Tropic, specifically as regards their matching Glimmung. And some say that it's not limited to Glimmungs. Some say...
She broke off, staring acutely ahead.
No, she said. Not this, not already. Not the first time.
A decaying hump of flopping fabric mingled with threads of cloth tottered toward them, propelled by the currents of murky water. It had a humanoid look, as if once, long ago, it had held itself erect, had walked on strong legs. Now it bowed from the waist, and its legs dangled as if the bones had been scooped out of them. He stared at it, and it came nearer, and he continued staring, because it seemed somehow to want to eddy into his vicinity, clumsily, so that its pace was slow. And yet it made progress forward. He made out its face now, and felt the world within him disintegrate.
It's your corpse, Molly said. You must understand, time down here is simply not...
It's blind, he said. Its eyes, they've rotted away, gone.
Can it see me?
It's aware of you. It wants...
She hesitated. What does it want? He demanded, snarling at her so that she shuddered.
It wants to talk to you, she said then,
and became totally silent. Now she merely observed, merely saw, and did nothing in either direction. She did not assist him, she did not assist his corrupted corpse, as if he thought she has withdrawn and is not here. I am alone with this thing.
What should I do? He asked her.
Not... She became silent once more, then abruptly said, Don't hear what it says.
You mean he can speak? He demanded, appalled. He could accept what he saw, he could retain his sanity when presented with his own dead body. But he could not believe beyond that. It could not be real, not sane.
It had to be the mimicry of some aquatic life form, something which saw him and managed in a plastic manner to adopt the semblance of his own shape.
It will tell you to go away, Molly said, to leave this world, this ocean, leave Heldskala forever, and Glimmung's hopes, his project. See, it's already trying to form words.
The decayed flesh of the lower face writhed. He saw broken teeth, and then, from within the cavity which his mouth had become, noise issued forth. A drumming, as if far off on a heavy ocean cable. Something extending for 500 miles, something which weighed so much. Something so dense, so hard to maneuver. And yet the thing tried. The drumming continued, and finally, as it bobbed before him, rotating slow motion and rising now, then sinking a little, he distinguished one word, then another.
Stay, it said,
and its mouth cavity gaped. Small fish floated in, disappeared, then floated skimmingly back out.
You must go ahead. Ahead. Lift Heldskala.
Are you still alive? He asked it. Molly said,
Nothing down here is really alive in the strict sense. Residual amounts, partial changes in a damaged battery.
But it's not yet, he said. This is the future.
There is no future down here, Molly said.
But it hasn't happened to me yet. I'm alive. I'm facing this ugly thing, this horrible mobile rot. It couldn't talk to me if I were it.
Obviously, Molly said. But the distinction isn't really complete between the two of you. Some of it is merged in you. Some of you remains in it. They are both you. You are both of them. The child is father to the man, remember? And the man is father to the corpse. But I thought it would say to you to go away. And instead he, it, wants you to remain. That's what it swam up here to tell you. I don't understand. This can't be your black in the sense that I was explaining it anyhow. It's badly decayed, but it's benign, and the blacks are never benign. Can I ask it something?
He said nothing. Molly took it as silent assent.
How did you die? She asked the corpse.
The exposed jawbone waggled whitely in the currents of water surrounding it as it drummed out its deformed words, its
answer. Glimmung had... us killed.
Us? She asked alertly. How many of us? All of us?
Us.
It extended a decomposed arm toward Joe.
We two.
It became silent then, and by degrees drifted away.
But it isn't so bad. I have a box I've made. It helps protect me. I get inside it and put up a barrier where the door, the entrance, is. And very few of the fish, the really dangerous fish, get in.
You mean you're trying to protect your life? Joe said. But your life is over. He did not comprehend. It made no sense. And it was eerie and bizarre. The thought of a decayed corpse, his corpse, living this semi-life down here, going through the motions of making itself safe. Improve living standards for the dead, he said savagely, speaking at large, to neither Mali nor the corrupted body floating before him.
The curse, Mali said.
What?
He said.
It won't let you go. It confronts you with your own final self, and yet you won't go away. And then later on, when you're this... She gestured at the corpse. You'll wish you had left. Today, tonight, tomorrow morning.
Stay,
the corpse said to Joe. Why? He said.
When Heldskalla is raised from the water, I will go to sleep. I am waiting to go to sleep. I'm glad you came at last. I have waited centuries. Until you come here and release me, I am caught in the totality of time.
It made an imploring gesture with its right arm and hand, but portions of the hand broke loose and fell away into the murky water. The hand now only had two fingers, and seeing this, Joe felt physically, substantially sickened. He thought, if I could turn the clock back and not have come here. But the corpse had said the opposite. His coming here meant its and his release. My good Jesus, he thought, I'll be that thing before long. Parts of my body will fall off and be snapped up by the dangerous fish. I will have to hide in a box down here at the bottom of the sea, and the fish will eat me piece by piece. Or maybe it's not true, he thought. Maybe this is not my corpse. How many people are confronted by their own corpse? A corpse talking beseechingly. The Kalends, he thought. But that made no sense, because, contrary to Molly's expectations, it had urged him to stay, urged him to begin his job of pot-healing. Glimmung, he thought. This is a phantasm projected by him, a warped, a deranged hook to gaff me. Obviously. He said to the bobbing, lingering corpse, Well, thanks for your advice. I'll take it under advisement.
Is my corpse here, too? Molly demanded.
No answer. Joe's physical remnants had floated away. Did I say the wrong thing? Joe asked himself. But ye gods, what are you supposed to say to your own corpse? I said I'd think its advice over. What more can it ask? He felt strangely angry, not frightened any longer or horrified, just the mundane boiling inside him of irritability. Pressure like this, it was unfair. He had been told that he must go ahead with his part of the project. And then he thought of the curse. Death, he said to Molly as they bobbed close to each other. Death and sin are connected. That means that if the cathedral is cursed, then we also... I'm going back up. She rose, drifting upward above him, her legs moving expertly. I don't want to find myself too close to the dredging operation. She pointed. He turned his body in that direction. An enormous silent instrument, a construct which he did not recognize, lay far to their right. He heard its activity now, the dull, low throbbing. Its sound had been there all this time, but he estimated in the form of a 20 cycles per second churning at the lower limit of audibility. Perhaps he had felt it as a vibration. Perhaps he still felt it that way now. What is it? He asked her, and started in that direction. It fascinated him.
A Caprix scoop, Molly said. Ionian Caprix, the element with the greatest atomic weight currently in use, replacing the older Rexoroid scoops that you used to see.
Is the entire cathedral going to be raised by the scoop? He asked Molly, who unwillingly flapped and dove beside him, following his course in a reluctant, halting manner.
Only the base, Molly said.
The rest is being cut into blocks?
Everything but the base, which is a solid slab of Deneb III agate. If it were sawed into blocks, it would be unable to support the superstructure, hence the scoop.
She hung back.
It's not safe to go so close. Anyhow, you've seen Caprix scoops and shovels in operation before. You know the principle they utilize. The fulcrum is passed back and forth among the four rims of the scoop. Now, please, let's go back up to the surface. I find it very exacting down here. Damn it, it's dangerous so near the dredging.
Are all the blocks cut?
Oh, God, Molly said wearily. No, not all. Only an initial few. The scoop is not yet lifting the base. It's merely inserting itself in place.
What will the ascent rate be? He asked.
That hasn't been decided. Look, we're not ready for that. You're talking about ascent rate while we're still involved in getting the scoop in place. This isn't your field. You have no knowledge about dredging. The scoop is moving horizontally at the rate of 6 inches per 26-hour day, which is virtually not moving at all.
He said, There's something you don't want me to see.
Paranoia, Molly said.
Flashing his bifocal light source to the right of the scoop, he made out something, a dense and opaque mass that soared up high, becoming a triangle of planes past which fish swam and onto which barnacles and bivalves and a host of unipodular mollusks and crustacea clung. And next to it, where the scoop slowly worked, an identical shape held Scala.
"That's what you didn't want me to see," he said to Molly. "Two cathedrals."
Chapter 12. "One of them," he said, "is black, the Black Cathedral."
"Not the one they're dredging," Molly said.
"Is he sure?" Joe said. "Could he make such a mistake?" It would kill Glimmung. He knew that intuitively. It would be the end of everything, and of them all, merely knowing that it existed and seeing it. He felt the sting of death. Ice settled over his heart and remained there. Hopelessly, he flashed his torch about here and there, as if trying to find, and failing to find, a way out.
"You now know," Molly said, "why I wanted to go back up."
He said, "I'll go up with you." He did not want to remain here any longer. Like Molly, he yearned for the surface, for the world above water. That world contained nothing like this, and he thought it never should. That was never intended. "Let's go," he said to Molly, and swam upward. With each passing second, he was farther up from these black-chilled depths and all that they held. "Give me your hand." He turned, reached back for her, and then he saw it, saw the pot, in the rays of his torch.